Coming up on this week's Book Show, bestselling author Michael Lewis's new book, The Premonition, A Pandemic Story, is a nonfiction thriller that pits a band of medical visionaries against the wall of ignorance that was the official response of the Trump administration to the COVID-19 outbreak. Michael Lewis on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Best-selling author Michael Lewis's new book, The Premonition, A Pandemic Story, is a nonfiction thriller that pits a band of medical visionaries against the wall of ignorance that was the official response of the Trump administration to the COVID-19 outbreak. In the book, we meet a 13-year-old girl whose science project on transmission of an airborne pathogen develops into a very grown-up model of disease control, a local public health officer who uses her worm's eye view to see what the CDC misses, a secret team of dissenting doctors nicknamed the Wolverines, who have everything necessary to fight the pandemic except official permission to implement their work. Michael Lewis is the best-selling author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short, The Undoing Project, and The Fifth Risk. The new book is The Premonition. It's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Lewis back to The Book Show. How are you, sir?
I'm great. You're catching me at the tail end of a book tour, so I feel, invigorated.
Well, that means you've answered every question, so hopefully I'll come up with one or two that you haven't answered yet. Doubtful, but we'll give it a shot. This book came to you, and I know you have been talking about this a lot, because you were done with The Fifth Risk, and you were thinking in one of those risks was, oh, what happens if a pandemic happens, and then a pandemic happens?
Yes. I mean, more generally, I thought, because The Fifth Risk had framed the federal government as a manager of a portfolio of existential risks, and was kind of asking the question, what happens to a society where it allows this manager to just corrode and the tools to sort of fall into disuse and disrepair? I didn't have any particular view about what the bad thing was going to be that happened. For all I knew, it was going to be a meteor striking the Earth. I just didn't know. But I did think that it's going to be an interesting exercise to do the pathology, the post-mortem on this after the fact. And so when this occurs, when this starts, I didn't know what the bad thing was, but now all of a sudden this was it. It was, at least in the beginning, it started as a way to speak to that book.
And I know you talk about this a lot as to how did you find the people that you talked to, but this is an amazing group of people who were very much under the radar and were doing a lot and scurrying, and you really came to them very quickly as you started to walk with them through the process.
I did, and I think I found them so quickly because they weren't that under the radar, right? I mean, the group of doctors known as the Wolverines, at the center of them are two doctors, Richard Hatchett and Carter Mesher, who, if you only turn the dial of reality slightly, they're running the pandemic out of the Trump administration. In the beginning of the Trump administration, they'd actually been basically badged in to come and do such a thing if a pandemic occurred. And then the person who badged them in, Tom Bossert, the Homeland Security Director, was fired. And so they were one step removed from the response rather than kind of like out in the wilderness. And ditto, Charity Dean, who was the deputy health officer, second in command at the California State Department of Health. But she had previously, for a few months, run the place and turned the dial slightly. And she's actually probably running the California response. And the third character, Joe DeRisi, who a UCSF biochemist, but for the purposes of this story, the important thing is he helps run something called the Chan Zuckerberg Biohub, which is this enterprise devoted to eliminating disease from the planet by the end of the 21st century. He was moments away from creating a global system of tripwires that would have spotted this thing very early. So they were all very close to being in charge without actually being in charge.
You talk about this, the group, the Wolverines, and a group of seven doctors, and they're positioned in and around the federal government, and they'd been together for quite some time, for about a decade and a half. And so by the time the pandemic comes, this group is basically looking at an administration that is disbanding everything. So they ultimately go rogue. Was Yes. that just a natural inclination for them?
No. It's a really curious group. There are seven doctors, and they're all really doctors. You know, they aren't people who just went to medical school and then moved on to get involved in public policy. They had hands-on experience as doctors, most of them in the military, but not all of them. And each of them had a kind of an independent, curious collision with public policy that got them at some point into the White House. But it makes them different from who you think of when you think of public policy types or Washington types. Those people are mostly lawyers. This is a curious subculture in American politics. These doctors who have had something to do with big questions of public policy, and they are institutional people. I mean, two of them created in the Bush White House the American strategy for dealing with a pandemic. One of them, Matt Hepburn, ran vaccine development for Operation Warp Speed. James Lawler, another one, runs a federal medical facility in Omaha, Nebraska, to which people with terrifying new diseases are sent to be treated and studied. I mean, they're not gadflies. They're institutional people who kind of watched in shock as the Trump administration decided it basically wasn't going to manage this event. And it got to the point where when James Lawler is asked by Charity Dean, like in March or around then, who's running this thing, Lawler says nobody's running it. But to the extent that anybody sort of is running it, we're sort of running it. And I think that speaks to like the authority they had in the circles they moved in. People cared what these people thought.
You say when it comes to our public health officers during the pandemic that the brave ones, the ones that came forward, basically got their heads chopped off. So that meant that they were being punished for doing what they needed to do. So they started to figure out how to do that without getting their head chopped off.
Well, they did. You know, if you look at it isn't just the state of California, but California, I think, is a microcosm. I mean, each state has a different structure, but California has 61 local health officers who really have their own authority in their own counties and three cities. A dozen or more have been run out of their offices with death threats and mobs outside their homes. And, I mean, they're just horrible things. And those dozen would have been, all have been on the list of the people who were best at their jobs before the pandemic. So there was this selective pressure placed on that role to drive out people who were going to be aggressive in combating disease. And that's a real problem. It's a real problem when the only way you survive is by kind of not doing your job or doing it in a kind of half-assed way or or in some cases being actually backed up by the politicians in your county. But this kind of thing happened in a lot of other places. Amy Acton was one of the leading health officers in the country, very good at her job, outspoken. She was the state health officer for Ohio. She got driven out of her job. I mean, I think that the system, such as it is, of public health, and there really isn't much of a system, but the system such as it is had configured itself to push all of the social risk and all of the need for bravery down on these obscure local officials who had very little social power, weren't paid well, didn't have a bully pulpit, served at the mercy of elected officials, and they were really ill-equipped to play the role we needed them to play. We didn't arm them for the war they had to fight.
Michael Lewis is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. It is published by Norton. So if we talk about the politicalization of the CDC, which we certainly saw and are seeing as a result of this pandemic, but you really go back and say this is something that started in the mid-70s.
Yeah, and it's not just the CDC. If you go back to kind of starting in the early 60s, there was a drift in the government to removing or changing jobs of running these institutions from being permanent civil service jobs to being politically appointed jobs. A series of events in the mid-70s led to, in the Reagan administration, the CDC director ceasing to be a career civil servant, a public servant, and becoming a presidential appointee. And that has, you know, and if you go across our government, this was happening. We now have 4,000-something presidential appointees who manage the government. But if you just look at the CDC as a case study of the effects of this, it's pernicious because what happens is, first, the person who is selected for the job is selected not from the pool of all Americans and for his ability or her ability to do the job. They're selected from a pool of people who are politically pleasing to the president. It's a smaller pool, and they might be good at the job, but you're already restricting the pool of candidates in a way that's not good for the institution. You put the person who is now in charge of the CDC on a very short leash. They can be fired on a whim by the president. And the third thing, and this is kind of an odd knock-on effect, is the person knows they're only there as long as the politician who's appointed them is there. These presidential appointees tend to serve 18 months to 2 years, as opposed to, you know, the 10 or 12 years that the early CDC directors served. When you do that, when you have people who've got kind of short-term outlook, they're renters rather than homeowners kind of thing, you just get a different kind of management. And I don't know, you know, it's funny, you look at our federal institutions, our government institutions, I don't think anybody could look at them and say that's how you would structure something to succeed. No private company could survive if the CEO was basically removed every couple of years and replaced by someone else, and everybody knew that was going to happen. All that combines to queer the role the CDC is willing to play in disease outbreak. Even before Trump arrives, and I think makes everything worse, anybody who was on the ground trying to control disease outbreaks, not COVID, obviously, but, you know, measles or meningitis, would have found themselves constantly frustrated by the CDC's unwillingness to engage, their insistence that we're going to wait to see how all this plays out before we join the battle. And if you, local health officer, put a foot wrong, you're going to get your head chopped off. You're going to take the risk. We're not going to take the risk. We instead are going to wait till all the data is in and write flawless academic papers about it. That's fine. It's important to have that academic institution, but it means that the place called the Centers for Disease Control is actually not engaged in controlling disease.
And in the end, for this pandemic, they're basically saying, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, nothing's wrong, and then, oh, there's something wrong, and it's too late for us to do anything about it.
Charity Dean, local health officer, said that was the great American shame. Now, maybe we couldn't have contained it the way, say, Australia has contained it, but we didn't even try. The CDC did a bunch of stuff early on that made it virtually impossible to contain while saying it posed no immediate threat to American lives. It's very of a piece with her experience of the CDC before COVID. And the experience is a real reluctance to make decisions in conditions of uncertainty, which is the nature of disease control. The unwillingness to kind of get out in front of it and say, even though the sky is blue, this is a time to be alarmed. We paid a price for that.
Charity Dean is one of the really greatest Michael Lewis characters I think I've ever read. She is so cool. There's so many things that you could say about this woman. And obviously, as you often do, you let her tell the story. But at one point, and this is early in the book, she says, "They think my spirit animal is a bunny and it's an effing dragon." That's great.
And I could tell you when she, I tell you when that came out of her. I mean, the stuff that came, I spent a lot of time with her, so it actually wasn't that hard to get that kind of stuff from her, because it kind of pours from her. But she didn't say it in as calm a tone as you just said it. And she said it because she was just remembering the many times that men who knew much less than her about something, some threat she was dealing with. Tuberculosis was a really good example because she was really made herself expert on tuberculosis, and people who were kind of armchair epidemiologists would try to mansplain to her. And she'd try to be polite, but at some point she just had it. And the point was where they were getting in the way of her controlling disease. She was obsessed with it. You know, all the greatest characters are obsessed with something. And all these characters in the book have their obsession. But her obsession, going back to childhood, is with communicable disease and gruesome death and preventing the first from creating the second. And she really has a gift for doing it. You know, it's one of the great moments, I thought, in just like when I was getting to know her and her environment. I went to the Santa Barbara County Health Office and I interviewed some of the nurses there, the public health nurses. And I'd heard some of the stories about Charity, and and the stories were so exotic and incredible. It was like every day sounded like a Netflix drama. And I said to one of the nurses, like, "Is it always like this here? Like, is there always some, you know, terrifying outbreak of tuberculosis in the Oaxacan community, or a terrifying outbreak of meningitis on the UCSB campus, and so on and so forth?" And one of the nurses said, "You know, it was funny. Not until she came here, but the minute she came here, just the weirdest things started to happen. And we thought it was just coincidence that Charity arrives and odd things start to happen. But then we realized that the odd things started to happen because she was here. And in particular, they happened because she was refusing just to let disease go, just let things ride. She was refusing to let basically the poor die horrible deaths. Because no one was paying attention to the movement of you know, say, for example, multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. And once she engages, that's when the drama starts.
You follow her at the beginning. We meet her in the 2000s. And how she slowly starts to become aware of what the CDC is. And there's a point where she says to you, "The Centers for Disease Control wasn't of much practical use to me. I was mad that the man behind the curtain ended up being so disappointing."
"Such a pansy," is what she said. She was just disappointed he was such a pansy. I came into this with no particular opinion about the CDC. In fact, if I had any kind of opinion, it was a rosy one. I might have told you that, wow, Trump just came in and destroyed this wonderful institution that would have saved us. I've never earned a right to my own opinion about the CDC, but Charity has. Charity and other local health officers have earned their right to have their opinion because they have put their careers and in some cases their lives on the line to stop disease. The role of the CDC is to back them up. It's to have their back. And when she came into the job of being a local health officer, Charity Dean thought that's what they would do. And then over and over and over again, they not only do not have her back, they're kind of forcing the risk upon her. They're kind of saying, it's sort of like the first lieutenant who turns to his troops in battle and says, you guys run into the machine gun fire and I'll be behind you if it works out. It got so bad that, think about this. It got so bad that Charity Dean, public health officer, banned CDC officers from her investigations, her disease investigations, because they got in the way. That's a problem. It's a problem that is a kind of premonition of the problems we're going to face as a society if a disease, is spreading around the country and the CDC is in charge of controlling it.
Well, and speaking of problems, in February of 2020, she said she was looking for the CDC to pull the fire alarm. The CDC does not know how to pull the fire alarm. In fact, there is no fire alarm in this country. That will scare the zippers off you.
It does. Her takeaway from all of this is that we are now seeing the consequences of there not really being a fire alarm in this country and the unwillingness of the institution that might sound the alarm to sound it early. And her takeaway is, it's a little bit of a peculiar takeaway, that the pandemic was Mother Nature's gift to us because it could have been so much worse and likely someday will be so much worse. This pandemic has alerted us to our lack of preparedness and our lack of an institution to actually deal with the problem. And she thinks that it might just be just enough to scare us into changing our institutions so that we can respond.
Ultimately, now she is doing it in the private sector.
It's both disheartening and interesting where she ends up, because she is, like many of the public sector people I've written about, very mission-driven and not at all interested in money, like ridiculously not interested in money. She takes the job as the local public health officer and turns her back on three times the salary to go work as a doctor. She's just not motivated by it. It doesn't mean anything to her once your needs are met. So the thought that this person, who is clearly highly competent, just great at what she does in the public sector, is driven to the point where she concludes that the public sector is not the place for me because they won't let me do what I do. They won't let me build the thing that needs to be built. And she looks around and says, so what is highly functional in this society? And she looks at the private sector. And she decides that I'm going to build something called the Public Health Company, which is going to do what the federal government has not yet done, which is basically network all the local health officers together, provide them with tools, perform the role of health officer for private companies for pay, but kind of create a system that the federal government is refusing to create, or a software capability. And in her fantasy, I think much to the chagrin of her investors, we're going to make some money keeping people safe in private spaces like cruise ships and airplanes and factories and so on and so forth. But what we're really going to do is we're going to create a mechanism for a national response that we're just going to give to the federal government. Now, how that all plays out, I don't know. But her first step out of the gate, it's very telling. This is a woman who couldn't get the $80,000 that she needed for a machine to test for particularly lethal tuberculosis when she was a local health officer. She gets millions of dollars thrown at her by venture capitalists, and all kinds of engineering talent from Silicon Valley wants to join her. And indeed, all the resources that are not available in the public sector are at her fingertips in the private sector. So she's not wrong. She's not wrong that this might be a path. It's just a little depressing that we don't have the will to do it in the public sector.
Isn't that one of the big takeaways from the book, that we are trying to figure out how to manage ourselves in a better way?
I think that's exactly right. I think that if you go back to before the pandemic, there was this curious exercise conducted by an enterprise in Washington called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And it's a very credible place. And it set about to rank all the countries in the world by their pandemic preparedness. They gathered dozens of experts, hundreds of researchers spent millions of dollars doing this. And while they concluded that no country on the planet was perfectly prepared for a pandemic, they ranked the United States first and the United Kingdom second. The U.S. and the U.K. have had peculiarly disastrous pandemics. Like the U.S. death toll is 20% of the global total, and we only have 4% of the population. And the U.K. is even slightly worse. And the question is kind of why? So why would experts look at our society and say, man, of all the places on Earth, this is the place that could handle a pandemic? Well, they say that because we have massive material resources, an incredible scientific infrastructure, more microbiology labs than anybody on Earth. We invented pandemic strategy and spread it all over the world. That there are reasons to think that we're particularly well prepared, a bit like there are reasons to think that, like, I don't know, a really top-notch college football team has the most talent and is going to win the most games before the season. And then the games get played and the football team stinks. The pandemic happens and our response is appalling. And the question is why? It clearly is not resources. It's not the wherewithal to deal with the problem. It's organizational. It's managerial. It's like we were badly coached. We were badly led. And maybe we were bad at being led. It points to a larger problem. And the larger problem is we need to figure out how to govern ourselves more effectively than we're now governing ourselves. And I think, I think I kind of sort of tilt towards optimism. But my takeaway is that like maybe we have a shot to see that that's our problem. And not just in pandemic planning, but in just our general governance. And think about our institutions in a different way.
I think you do very much tilt toward optimism because you're saying to us there are these people, the Carter Meshers and Charity Deans, who are doing really good work and they know a lot of stuff. They've seen it and they know it. We just have to start paying attention to them.
Paying attention to them, and what they would tell you is that this isn't a problem of bad people. It's not like they're bad people in the CDC. This is a problem of a bad system. Like you can see some instant changes you could make to make the system work a bit better. And one of the changes would be depoliticize it. You return it into the hands of a permanent civil service. You do this with real discipline. That you don't. None of my characters want big government. What they all want is like a government for the 21st century, a smart government, an agile government. And what I'm saying is that, yeah, my characters are peculiar people. They're extraordinarily talented. They're shockingly brave. They're fun to read about and to be with and to see the pandemic through. But they alone aren't the solution. Just them being in charge is not going to work if the system is what it is. The system needs to be fixed.
Michael Lewis's new book is The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. It is published by Norton. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.